"How many spears do we have?" I asked. Lancelot had ignored me till then. I knew he had not forgotten our meeting of 2 years before, but he nevertheless smiled at my question. "We have 420 men under arms, and each of them has a spear. Can you work out the answer?" I returned the silky smile. "Spears break, Lord Prince, and men defending walls throw their spears like javelins. When 420 spears are thrown, what do we throw next?"
"Oh, it's—" Keelup growled,
luckily too softly for Ban to hear.
"There are spares," Lancelot said airily. "And besides, we shall use the spears the Franks throw at us."
"Poets, for sure," Keelup said.
"You spoke, Lord Keelup?"
Lancelot asked.
"I belched, Lord Prince. But while I have your gracious attention, do we have archers?"
"Some."
"Many?"
10.
"The gods help us," Keelup said, and slid down in his chair. He hated chairs.
Elaine spoke next, reminding us that the island was sheltering women, children, and the world's greatest poets.
"The safety of the Fili is in your hands," she told us, "and you know what will happen to them if you fail."
I kicked Keelup to stop him from making a comment. Ban stood and gestured towards his library.
7,843 scrolls are in there," he said solemnly. "The accumulated treasures of human knowledge, and if the city falls, so will civilization."
He then told us an ancient tale of a hero going into a labyrinth to kill a monster, and trailing behind him a woolen thread, with which he could find his way out of the darkness.
"My library,"
he finally explained the point of the long tale,
"is that thread. Lose it, gentlemen, and we stay in eternal darkness. So I beg you, fight."
He paused, smiling.
"And I have summoned help. Letters are gone to Brasiliand and to Arthur. I think the day is not far off when our horizon will be thick with friendly sails. And Arthur, remember, is oath-bound to help us."
"Arthur," Keelup intervened, "has his hands full of Saxons."
"An oath is an oath,"
Ban said reprovingly. Galahad inquired whether we planned to make our own raids on the Frankish encampments ashore. We could easily go by boat, he said, landing east or west of their positions. But Lancelot turned down the idea.
"If we leave the walls," he said, "we die. It is that simple."
"No sallies?" Keelup asked in disgust.
"If we leave the walls," Lancelot repeated, "we die. Your orders are simple. You stay behind the walls."
He announced that Benwick's best warriors, 100 veterans of the war on the mainland, would guard the main gate. We 50 surviving Dumnonians were given the western walls, while the city's levies, bolstered by fugitives from the mainland, guarded the rest of the island. Lancelot himself, with a company of the white-cloaked palace guard, would form the reserve that would watch the fighting from the palace and come down to intervene wherever their help was needed.
"Might as well call on the fairies," Keelup growled to me.
"Another belch?"
Lancelot inquired.
"It's all the fish I eat, Lord Prince," Keelup said.
King Ban invited us to inspect his library before we left, perhaps wanting to impress us with the value of what we defended. Most of the men who had been at the Council of War shuffled in, gaped at the pigeonholed scrolls, then went to stare at the bare-breasted harpist who played in the library's antechamber. Galahad and I lingered longer among the books, where the hump-backed Father Selwyn was still bent over his old table, where he was trying to keep his grey cat from playing with his quill.
"Still working out the wingspan of angels, Father?" I asked him.
"Someone must," he said,
then turned to scowl at me with his one eye.
"Who are you?"
"Derval, Father, of Dumnonia. We met 2 years ago. I'm surprised you're still here."
"Your surprise is of no interest to me, Derval of Dumnonia. Besides, I did leave for a while. I went to Rome,
filthy place. I thought the Vandals might have cleaned it up, but the place is still full of priests and their plump little boys. So I came back here. Man's harpists are much prettier than Rome's catamites.
He gave me an unfriendly look.
Do you care about my safety, Dervil of Dumnonia?
I could hardly answer no, though I was tempted to. My job is to protect lives, I said rather pretentiously.
Including yours, father. Then I put my life in your hands, Dervil of Dumnonia, he said,
as he turned his ugly face back to the table and pushed the cat away from his quill.
I lay my life on your conscience, Dervil of Dumnonia. And now you can go and fight and leave me to do something useful.
I tried to ask the priest about Rome, but he waved my questions away, and so I went down to the storehouse on the western wall that would be our home for the rest of the siege. Galahad, who considered himself an honorary Dumnonian now, was with us, and he and I tried to count the Franks who were retreating from the incoming tide after another attempt to discover the track across the sands. The bards, singing of Innis Treib's siege, say the enemy outnumbered the grains of sand in the bay. They were not quite that many, but still they were formidable. Every Frankish warband in western Gaul had combined to help capture Innis Treib's, the jewel of Armorica, which, it was rumoured, was crammed with the treasures of Rome's fallen empire. Galahad estimated we were faced by 3,000 Franks. My guess was 2,000, while Lancelot assured us there were 10,000. But by anyone's count, there was a terrible lot of them. The first attacks brought the Franks nothing but disaster. They found a way across the sand and assaulted the main gate and were repelled bloodily. Then, the next day, they attacked our part of the wall and were given the same treatment, only this time they stayed too long, and a large part of their force was cut off by the incoming tide. Some tried to wade to the mainland and were drowned. Others retreated to the shrinking stretch of sand before our walls, where they were slaughtered by a sally of spearmen, led from the gate by Blethig, the chief who had fetched me to Benwick, and who was now the leader of Benwick's veterans. Blethig's sortie across the sand was in direct disobedience to Lancelot's rule that we must stay inside the city's wall. But the dead were so many that Lancelot pretended to have ordered the attack, and later, after Blethig's death, he even claimed to have led the sally. The filly made a song, telling how Lancelot had dammed the bay with Frankish dead. But in truth, the prince stayed in the palace while Blethig attacked. For days afterwards, the bodies of Frankish warriors swilled around the island's base, carried by the tide and providing rich carrion for the gulls. The Franks then began to build a proper causeway. They cut hundreds of trees and laid them on the sand, then weighted the trunks with rocks carried to the shore by slaves. The tides in Innis Treib's wide bay were fierce, sometimes rising 40 feet, and the new causeway was ripped by the currents, so that at low tide the flats were littered with floating logs. But always the Franks brought more trees and stone, and so plugged the gaps. They had captured thousands of slaves, and did not care how many died in building the new road. The causeway became longer as our food supplies grew shorter. Our few remaining boats still went fishing, and others carried grain from Brasiliand. But the Franks launched their own boats from the shore, and after two of our fishing boats were captured and their crews disemboweled, our shipmasters stayed at home. The poets on the hilltop, posturing with their spears, lived off the palace's rich stores, but we warriors scraped barnacles off the rocks, ate mussels and razor clams, or stewed the rats we trapped in our storehouse that was still filled with pelts, salt, and barrels of nails. We did not starve. We had willow fish traps at the base of the rocks, and most days they yielded a few small fish, though at low tide the Franks would send raiding parties to destroy the traps. At high tide, the Frankish boats rowed round the island to pull up the fish traps set further from the city's shore. The bay was shallow enough for the enemy to see the traps, and then to break them with spears. One such boat grounded on its return to the mainland, and was left stranded a quarter mile from the city as the tide fell. Killuk ordered a sortie, and 30 of us climbed down fishing nets suspended from the wall's top. The 12 men of the boat's crew fled as we approached, and inside the abandoned craft we found a barrel of salted fish and 2 dry loaves of bread that we carried back in triumph. When the tide rose, we brought the boat back to the city and tied it safe beneath our wall. Lancelot watched our disobedience, but sent no reprimand, though a message did come from Queen Elaine demanding to know what supplies we had fetched back from the ship. We sent some dried fish up the road, and no doubt the gift was construed as an insult. Lancelot then accused us of capturing the boat, so that we could desert in his Trebes, and ordered us to deliver the ship to the island's small harbour. For answer, I climbed the hill to the palace, and demanded that he back up his accusation of cowardice with his sword. I shouted the challenge around the courtyard, but the prince and his poets stayed inside their locked doors. I spat on their threshold and left. Galahad was happier the more desperate things became. Part of his happiness sprang from the presence of Leonor, the harpist who had welcomed me 2 years before, the girl for whom Galahad had confessed his lust to me, the same girl Lancelot had raped. She and Galahad lived in a corner of the storeroom. We all had women. There was something about the hopelessness of our plight that eroded normal behaviour, and so we crammed as much living as we could into those hours before our expected deaths. The women stood guard with us, and hurled rocks whenever the Franks tried to dismantle our fragile fish traps. We had long run out of spears, except for those we had brought to Benwick ourselves, and which we were saving for the main assault. Our handful of archers had no missiles, except the ones shot into the city by the Franks, and that supply increased when the enemy's causeway was a short bow shot from the city gate. The Franks erected a timber fence at the end of the causeway, and their archers stood behind the fence and poured arrows on the gate's defenders. The Franks made no attempt to extend the causeway all the way to the city, for the new roadway was only ever intended to give them a dry passage to the place where their assault could begin. We knew that attack must come soon. It was early summer when the causeway was finished. The moon was full and brought huge tides. For much of the time the causeway was under water, but at low tide the sand stretched wide about Innis Trebes, and the Franks, who were learning the secrets of the sandflats day by day, ranged all about us. Their drums were our constant music, and their threats were ever in our ears. One day brought a feast special to their tribes, and instead of attacking us, they lit great fires on the beach, then marched a column of slaves to the causeway's end, where, one by one, the captives were beheaded. The slaves were Britons, some of them with relatives watching from the city's wall, and the barbarism of the slaughter goaded some of Innis Trebes' defenders to rush out of the gate in a vain attempt to rescue the doomed women and children. The Franks were waiting for the attack, and formed a shield wall on the sand. But the men of Innis Trebes, crazed by anger and hunger, charged home. Blethig was one of the attackers. He died that day, cut down by a Frankish spear. We Dumnonians watched as a handful of survivors fled back to the city. There was nothing we could have done except add our corpses to the pile. Blethig's body was flayed, disemboweled, then planted on a stake at the causeway's end, so that we were forced to look at him until the next high tide. Somehow, though, the body stayed on the stake, despite being immersed, so that next morning, in a grey dawn, the gulls were tearing at his salt-washed corpse. "We should have charged with Blethig," Galahad told me bitterly. "No,
Better to have died like a man in front of a shield wall than be starved here. You'll get your chance to fight the shield wall, I promised him. But I also took what steps I could to help my people in defeat. We barricaded the alleys leading to our sector, so that should the Franks break into the island city, we could hold them at bay while our women were taken on a narrow, rock-bound path that twisted across the shoulder of the granite peak to a tiny cleft on the island's northwestern shore, where we had hidden our captured ship. The cleft was no kind of harbour, so we protected our ship by filling it with stones so that the tide flooded it twice a day. Underwater, the fragile hull was safe from being pounded against the cleft's rocky sides by the wind and waves. I guessed that the enemy assault would be made at low water, and two of our wounded men were under instructions to empty the boat of its rocks as soon as the attack began, so that the craft would float on the flooding tide. The idea of escaping in the boat was desperate, but it gave our people heart. No ships came to our rescue. One morning a great sail was seen in the north, and the rumour flashed about the city that Arthur himself was coming. But gradually the sail hauled off and disappeared in the summer haze. We were alone. At night we sang songs and told tales, while by day we watched the Frankish warbands gather on the shore. Those warbands made their assault on a summer afternoon, late on a falling tide. They came in a great swarm of leather-armoured men, iron-helmeted, with wooden shields held high. They crossed the causeway, leapt off its end, and climbed the gentle slope of sand towards the city gate. The leading attackers carried a huge log as a battering ram, its end fire-hardened and sheathed in leather, while the men who followed brought long ladders. One horde came and threw their ladders against our walls.
"Let them climb!"
Kiluk bellowed at our soldiers. He waited until one ladder held five men, then hurled a huge boulder straight down between its uprights. The Franks screamed as they were plucked off the rungs. An arrow glanced off Kiluk's helmet as he hurled another stone. More arrows rattled on the wall or hissed over our heads, while a rain of light-throwing spears clattered uselessly against the stone. The Franks were a churning dark mass at the wall's foot, into which we hurled rocks and sewage. Cavan managed to lift one ladder clean over the wall, and we broke it into scraps that we rained down on our attackers. Four of our women struggled to the ramparts with a fluted stone column taken from a city doorway, and we heaved it over the wall and took pleasure in the terrible screams of the men it crushed.
"This is how the darkness comes!"
Galahad shouted at me. He was exultant, fighting the last battle and spitting in death's eye. He waited for a Frank to reach a ladder's top, then gave a mighty slash with his sword so that the man's head bounded off down to the sand. The rest of the dead man's corpse stayed clinging to the ladder, obstructing the Franks behind, who became easy targets for our stones. We were breaking down the storehouse wall now to make our ammunition, and we were winning the fight too, for fewer and fewer Franks dared to try and climb the ladders. Instead, they retreated from the wall's base, and we jeered at them, told them they had been beaten by women, but if they attacked again, we would wake our warriors to the fight. Whether they understood our taunts, I cannot tell, but they hung back, fearful of our defences. The main attack still seethed at the gate, where the sound of the battering ram's pounding head was like a giant drum, sickening the whole bay. The sun stretched the shadows of the bay's western headland long across the sand, while high pink clouds made bars across the sky. Gulls flew to their roosts. Our two wounded men had gone to empty our boat of stones. I hoped no Franks had reached that far about the island to discover the craft. Yet I did not think we would even need it. Evening was falling, and the tide was rising, so that soon the water would drive the attackers back to the causeway, then back to their encampments, and we would celebrate a famous victory. But then we heard the battle roar of cheering men from beyond the city's gate,
and we saw our defeated Franks run from before our wall to join that distant assault, and we knew the city was lost. Later, talking to survivors, we discovered that the Franks had succeeded in climbing the harbour's stone quay, and now they were swarming into the city. And so the screaming began. Galahad and I took 20 men across our nearest barricade. Women were running towards us, but seeing us, they panicked and tried to climb the granite hill. Kiluk stayed to guard our wall and to protect our retreat to the boat as the first smoke of a defeated city curled into the evening sky. We ran behind the main gate's defenders, turned down a flight of stone steps, and there saw the enemy, scrambling like rats into a granary. Hundreds of enemy spearmen were flooding up from the quay. Their bullhorn standards were advancing everywhere. Their drums were beating, while the women trapped in the city's houses were shrieking. Off to our left, at the harbour's far side, where only a few attackers had gained a lodgment, a surge of white-cloaked spearmen suddenly appeared. Bors, Lancelot's cousin and the commander of the palace guard, was leading a counter-attack, and for a moment I thought he would turn the day and seal off the invaders' retreat. But instead of assaulting along the quay, Bors led his men to the sea steps, where a fleet of small boats waited to take them all to safety. I saw Prince Lancelot hurrying amid the guard, bringing his mother by the hand and leading a clutch of panicking courtiers. The Fili were fleeing the doomed city. Galahad cut down two men trying to climb the steps. Then I saw the street behind us fill with dark-cloaked Franks.
"Back!"
I shouted, and hauled Galahad away from the alley.
"Let me fight!"
He tried to pull away from me and faced the next two men coming up the narrow stone steps.
"Live, you fool!"
I pushed him behind me, feinted left with my spear, then brought it up and rammed its blade into a Frank's face. I let go of the shaft, took the second man's spear thrust on my shield while I drew Howlbane. Then I gave the low jab under the shield's edge that sent the man screaming to the steps, with blood welling between hands that cupped his groin.
"You know how to get us safe through the city!"
I shouted at Galahad. I abandoned my spear as I pushed him back from the battle-maddened enemies who were surging up the steps. There was a potter's shop at the head of the steps, and despite the siege, the shopkeeper's wares were still displayed on trestle tables under a canvas awning. I tipped a table full of jugs and vases into the attacker's path, then ripped down the awning and hurled it into their faces.
"Lead us!"
I screamed. There were alleys and gardens that only Innis Treib's inhabitants knew, and we would need such secret paths if we were to escape. The invaders had broken through the main gate now, to cut us off from Kiluk and his men. Galahad led us uphill, turned left into a short tunnel that ran beneath a temple, then across a garden and up to a wall that edged a rain cistern. Beneath us, the city writhed in horror. The victorious Franks broke down doors to take revenge for their dead left on the sand. Children wailed and were silenced by swords. I watched one Frankish warrior, a huge man with horns on his helmet, cut down four trapped defenders with an axe. More smoke poured up from houses. The city might have been built of stone, but there was plenty of furniture, boat pitch, and timber roofs to feed a maniacal fire. Out at sea, where the incoming tide swirled across the sandbanks, I could see Lancelot's winged helmet bright in one of the three escaping boats, while above me, pink in the setting sun, the graceful palace waited for its last moments. The evening breeze snatched at the grey smoke and softly billowed a white curtain that hung in a shadowed palace window.
"Over here!"
Galahad called, pointing to a narrow path.
"Follow the path to our boat!"
Our men ran for their lives.
"Come on, Derval!"
he called to me. But I did not move. I was staring up the steep hill.
"Come on, Derval!"
Galahad insisted. But I was hearing a voice in my head. It was an old man's voice, a dry, sardonic, and unfriendly voice, and the sound of it would not let me move.
"Come on, Derval!"
Galahad screamed.
"I put my life in your hands," the old man had said.
and suddenly he spoke again inside my skull.
I lay my life on your conscience, Dervil of Dumnonia.
How do I reach the palace? I called to Galahad.
Palace? How?
I shouted angrily.
This way,
he said.
This way!
We climbed.
The bards sing of love. They celebrate slaughter. They extol kings and flatter queens. But were I a poet, I would write in praise of friendship. I have been fortunate in friends. Arthur was one, but of all my friends there was never another like Galahad. There were times when we understood each other without speaking, and others when words tumbled out for hours. We shared everything, except women. I cannot count the number of times we stood shoulder to shoulder in the shield wall, or the number of times we divided our last morsel of food. Men took us for brothers, and we thought of ourselves in the same way. And on that broken evening, as the city smouldered into fire beneath us, Galahad understood I could not be taken to the waiting boat. He knew I was in the hold of some imperative, some message from the gods that made me climb desperately towards the serene palace crowning Innistrebes. All around us, horror flooded up the hill, but we stayed ahead of it, running desperately across a church roof, jumping down to an alley where we pushed through a crowd of fugitives who believed the church would give them sanctuary. Then up a flight of stone steps, and so to the main street that circled Innistrebes. There were Franks running towards us, competing to be the first into Ban's palace. But we were ahead of them, along with a pitiful handful of people who had escaped the slaughter in the lower town and were now seeking a hopeless refuge in the hilltop dwelling. The guards were gone from the courtyard. The palace doors lay open, and inside, where women cowered and children cried, the beautiful furniture waited for the conquerors. The curtains stirred in the wind. I plunged into the elegant rooms, ran through the mirrored chamber, and past Leonore's abandoned harp, and so to the great room where Ban had first received me. The king was still there, still in his toga, and still at his table with a quill in his hand.
"It's too late,"
he said, as I burst into the room with sword drawn.
"Arthur failed me."
Screams shouted in the palace corridors. The view from the arched windows was smeared by smoke.
"Come with us, father," Galahad said.
"I have work to do,"
Ban said querulously. He dipped his quill into the inkhorn and began to write.
"Can't you see I'm busy?"
I pushed through the door which led to the library, crossed the empty antechamber, then thrust open the library door to see the hunchbacked priest standing at one of the scroll shelves. The polished wooden floor was littered with manuscripts.
"Your life is mine!"
I shouted angrily, resenting that such an ugly old man had put me to this obligation, when there were so many other lives to save in the city.
"So come with me! Now!"
The priest ignored me.
He was frantically pulling scrolls from the shelves, tearing off their ribbons and seals and scanning the first lines before throwing them down and snatching other scrolls.
"Come on!"
I snarled at him.
"Wait!"
Selwyn insisted, pulling down another scroll, then discarded it and ripped another open.
"Not yet!"
A crash sounded in the palace, a cheer resounded and was drowned in screams. Galahad was standing in the library's outer door, pleading with his father to come with us, but Ban just waved his son away as though his words were a nuisance. Then the door burst open, and three sweating Frankish warriors rushed in. Galahad ran to meet them, but he had no time to save his father's life, and Ban did not even try to defend himself. The leading Frank hacked at him with a sword, and I think the King of Benwick was already dead of a broken heart before the enemy's blade ever touched him. The Frank tried to cut off the king's head, and that man died on Galahad's spear, while I lunged at the second man with Halbane and swung his wounded body around to obstruct the third. The dying Frank's breath reeked of ale like the breath of Saxons. Smoke showed outside the door,
Galahad was beside me now, his spear slashing forward to kill the third man. But more Franks were pounding down the corridor outside. I pulled my sword free and backed into the antechamber.
"Come on, you old fool!"
I screamed over my shoulder at the obstinate priest.
"Old, yes, Stervil, but a fool never."
The priest laughed, and something about that sour laughter made me turn, and I saw, as though in a dream, that the hunched back was disappearing as the priest stretched his long body to its full height. He was not ugly at all, I thought, but wonderful and majestic, and so full of wisdom that even though I was in a place of death that reeked of blood and echoed with the shrieks of the dying, I felt safer than I had ever felt in all my life. He was still laughing at me, delighted at having deceived me for so long.
"Merlin,"
I said, and I confess there were tears in my eyes.
"Give me a few minutes," he said.
"Hold them off." He was still plucking down scrolls, tearing at their seals and dropping them after a cursory glance. He had taken off the eye patch, which had merely been a part of his disguise.
"Hold them off,"
he said again, moving to a new rack of unexamined scrolls.
"I hear you're good at slaughter, so be very good at it now."
Galahad put the harp and the harpist's stool into the outer doorway. Then the two of us defended the passage with spear, sword, and shields.
"Did you know he was here?"
I asked Galahad.
"Who?"
Galahad rammed his spear into a round Frankish shield and jerked it back.
"Merlin!" "He is?"
Galahad was astonished.
"Of course I didn't know."
A screaming Frank with ringleted hair and blood on his beard rammed a spear at me. I gripped it just below the head and used it to tug him onto my sword. Another spear was thrown past me and buried its steel head in the lintel behind. A man tangled his feet in the cacophonous harp strings and stumbled forward to be kicked in the face by Galahad. I chopped the edge of my shield onto the back of the man's neck, then parried a sword cut. The palace rang with screams and was filling with acrid smoke, but the men attacking us were losing interest in any plunder they might discover in the library, preferring easier pickings elsewhere in the hilltop building.
"Merlin's here,"
Galahad asked me in disbelief.
"Well, look for yourself."
Galahad turned to stare at the tall figure, who was so desperately searching among Ban's doomed library.
"That's Merlin."
"Yes."
How did you know he was here?"
"I didn't," I said.
"Come on, you bastard."
This was to a big Frank, leather cloaked and carrying a double-headed war axe, who wanted to prove himself a hero. He chanted his war hymn as he charged, and was still chanting as he died. The axe buried itself in the floorboards by Galahad's feet as he pulled his spear from the man's chest.
"I have it! I have it!"
Merlin suddenly shouted behind us.
"Silius Italicus, of course. He never wrote 18 books on the Second Punic War, only 17. How can I have been so stupid?" "You're right, Dervil. I am an old fool, a dangerous fool. 18 books on the Second Turgid War? The merest child knows there were only ever 17. I have it. Come on, Dervil. Don't waste my time. We can't loiter here all night."
We ran back into the disordered library, where I rammed the big work table up against the door as a temporary barrier, while Galahad kicked open the shutters on the windows facing the west. A new swarm of Franks surged through the harpist's room, and Merlin snatched the wooden cross from around his neck and hurled the feeble missile at the invaders, who were momentarily checked by the heavy table. As the cross fell, a great burst of flame engulfed the antechamber. I thought the deadly fire was mere coincidence, and that the wall to the room had collapsed to let in a furnace surge just as the cross struck, but Merlin claimed it as his own triumph.
"The horrible thing has to be good for something," he said of the cross,
then cackled at the screaming, burning enemy.
"Roast, you worms! Roast!"
He was thrusting the precious scroll into the breast of his gown.
"Did you ever read Silius Italicus?"
he asked me.
"Never heard of him, Lord,"
I said, tugging him towards the open window.
"He wrote epic verse, my dear Dervil, epic verse."
He resisted my panicked tugging and placed a hand on my shoulder.
"Let me give you some advice."
He spoke very seriously.
shun epic verse. I speak from experience.
I suddenly wanted to cry like a child. It was such a relief to look into his wise and wicked eyes again. It was like being reunited with my own father.
I've missed you, Lord, I blurted out.
Don't go sentimental on me now, Merlin snapped,
then hurried to the window, as a Frankish warrior burst through the flames in the doorway and slid along the table's top, screaming defiance. The man's hair was smoking as he thrust his spear towards us. I knocked his blade aside with my shield, lunged with the sword, kicked him, and lunged again.
This way!
Galahad shouted from the garden beyond the window. I gave the dying Frank a last cut, then saw that Merlin had gone back to his work table.
Hurry, Lord!
I shouted to him.
The cat, Merlin explained. I can't abandon the cat. Don't be absurd.
Oh, for the God's sake, Lord!
I yelled at him. But Merlin was scrabbling under the table to retrieve the frightened grey cat that he cradled in his arms as he at last scrambled over the sill into a herb garden protected by low bay hedges. The sun was splendid in the west, drenching the sky brilliant red and shivering its fiery reflection across the waters of the bay. We crossed the hedge and followed Galahad down a flight of steps that led to a gardener's hut, then on to a perilous path that ran around the breast of the granite peak. On one side of the path was a stone cliff, and on the other, air. But Galahad knew these tracks from childhood and led us confidently down towards the dark waters. Bodies floated in the sea. Our boat, crowded to the point where it was a miracle it could even float at all, was already a quarter mile off the island, with its oars labouring to drag its weight of passengers to safety. I cupped my hands and shouted,
Kilok!
My voice echoed off the rock and faded across the sea, where it was lost in the immensity of cries and wailing that marked Innistrieb's end.
Let them go, Merlin said calmly,
then searched under the dirty robe he had worn as Father Selwyn.
Hold this.
He thrust the cat into my arms, then groped again under his robe until he found a small silver horn that he blew once. It gave a sweet note. Almost immediately, a small dark wherry appeared around Innistrieb's northern shore. A single-robed man propelled the little boat with a long sweep that was gripped by an oarlock at the stern. The wherry had a high-pointed prow and room in its belly for just three passengers. A wooden chest lay on the bottom boards, branded with Merlin's seal of the horned god, Sir Nonnos.
I made these arrangements, Merlin said airily, when it became apparent that poor Ban had no real idea what scrolls he possessed. I thought I would need more time, and so it proved. Of course the scrolls were labelled, but the filly were forever mixing them up. Not to say trying to improve them when they weren't stealing the verse and calling it their own. One wretch spent 6 months plagiarizing Catullus, then filed him under Plato. Good evening, my dear Cathig.
He greeted the boatman genially.
All is well?
Other than the world dying, yes,
Cathig growled in answer.
But you've got the chest.
Merlin gestured at the sealed box.
Nothing else matters.
The elegant wherry had once been a palace boat, used to ferry passengers from the harbour to the larger ships anchored offshore, and Merlin had arranged for it to wait his summons. Now we stepped aboard and sank to its deck as the Dŵr Cathig thrust the small craft out into the evening sea. A single spear plunged from the heights to be swallowed by the water alongside us, but otherwise our departure was unnoticed and untroubled. Merlin took the cat from me and settled contentedly in the boat's bows, while Galahad and I stared back at the island's death. Smoke poured across the water. The cries of the doomed were a wailing Thredni in the dying day. We could see the dark shapes of Frankish spearmen still crossing the causeway and splashing off its end towards the fallen city. The sun sank, darkening the bay and making the flames in the palace brighter. A curtain caught the fire and flared, brief and vivid before crumbling to soft ash. The library burned fiercest, scroll after scroll bursting into quick flame to make that corner of the palace into an inferno,
It was King Ban's balefire, burning through the night. Galahad wept. He knelt on the deck, clutching his spear, and watched his home turn to dust. He made the sign of the cross and said a silent prayer that willed his father's soul to whatever other world Ban had believed in. The sea was mercifully calm. It was coloured red and black, blood and death, a perfect mirror for the burning city where our enemy danced in ghoulish triumph. Innis Trebes was never rebuilt in our time. The walls fell, the weeds grew, seabirds roosted there. Frankish fishermen avoided the island where so many had died. They did not call it Innis Trebes anymore, but gave it a new name in their own coarse tongue, the Mount of Death. And at night, their seamen say, when the deserted isle looms black out of an obsidian sea, the cries of women and the whimpering of children can still be heard. We landed on an empty beach on the western side of the bay. We abandoned the boat and carried Merlin's sealed chest up through wind and gale-bent thorn to the headland's high ridge. Full night fell as we reached the summit, and I turned to see Innis Trebes glowing like a ragged ember in the dark. Then I walked on to carry my burden home to Arthur's conscience. Innis Trebes was dead. We took ship for Britain out of the same river where I had once prayed that Bel and Manawydan would see me safe home. We found Kilok in the river, his overloaded boat grounded on the mud. Leonor was alive, and so were most of our men. One ship fit to make the voyage home was left in the river, its master having waited in hope of making a fat profit from desperate survivors. But Kilok put his sword to the man's throat and had him take us home for free. The rest of the river's people had already fled from the Franks. We waited through a night made garish by the reflected flames of Innis Trebes burning, and in the morning we raised the ship's anchor and sailed north. Merlin watched the shore recede, and I, scarce daring to believe that the old man had really come back to us, gazed at him. He was a tall, bony man, perhaps the tallest I ever knew, with long white hair that grew back from his tonsure line to be gathered in a black-ribboned pigtail. He had worn his hair loose and dishevelled when he pretended to be Selwyn, but now, with the pigtail restored, he looked like the old Merlin. His skin was the colour of old polished wood. His eyes were green, and his nose a sharp, bony prow. His beard and moustaches were plaited into fine cords that he liked to twist in his fingers when he was thinking. No one knew how old he was, but certainly I never met anyone older, unless it was the druid Belize, nor did I ever know any man who seemed so ageless as Merlin. He had all his teeth, every last one, and retained a young man's agility, though he did love to pretend to be old and frail and helpless. He dressed in black, always in black, never another colour, and habitually carried a tall black staff, though now, fleeing from Armorica, he lacked that badge of office. He was a commanding man. Not just because of his height, reputation, or the elegance of his frame, but because of his presence. Like Arthur, he had the ability to dominate a room and to make a crowded hall seem empty when he left. But where Arthur's presence was generous and enthusiastic, Merlin's was always disturbing. When he looked at you, it seemed that he could read the secret part of your heart, and, worse still, find it amusing. He was mischievous, impatient, impulsive, and totally, utterly wise. He belittled everything, maligned everyone, and loved a few people wholly. Arthur was one, Namui another, and I I think, was a third, though I could never really be sure, for he was a man who loved pretense and disguises.
"You're looking at me, Derval," he accused me from the boat's stern,
where he still had his back turned towards me. "I hope never to lose sight of you again, Lord."
"What an emotional fool you are, Derval."
He turned and scowled at me.
"I should have thrown you back into Tanner Burz's pit. Carry that chest into my cabin."
Merlin had commandeered the shipmaster's cabin, where I now stowed the wooden chest. Merlin ducked under the low door, fussed with the captain's pillows to make himself a comfortable seat, then sank down with a sigh of happiness. The grey cat leapt onto his lap as he unrolled the top few inches of the thick scroll he had risked his life to obtain on a crude table that glittered with fish scales. "What is it?" I asked.
"It is the one real treasure Ban possessed," Merlin said. "The rest was mostly Greek and Roman rubbish. A few good things, I suppose, but not much."
"So what is it?" I asked again.
"It is a scroll, dear Derval," he said,
as though I was a fool to have asked. He glanced up through the open skylight to see the sail bellying in a wind still soured by Innistrieb smoke.
"A good wind," he said cheerfully. "Home by nightfall, perhaps. I have missed Britain."
He looked back to the scroll.
"And Numui, how is the dear child?"
he asked as he scanned the first lines. "The last time I saw her," I said bitterly, "she'd been raped and had lost an eye."
"These things happen," Merlin said carelessly.
His callousness took my breath away. I waited, then again asked him what was so important about the scroll. He sighed.
"You are an importunate creature, Derval. Well, I shall indulge you."
He let go of the manuscript so that it rolled itself up, then leaned back on the shipmaster's damp and threadbare pillows.
"You know, of course, who Colethin was?"
"No, Lord," I admitted. He threw his hands up in despair.
"Are you not ashamed of your ignorance, Derval? Colethin was a druid of the Ordovicii, a wretched tribe, and I should know. One of my wives was an Ordovician, and one such creature was sufficient for a dozen lifetimes." "Never again?"
He shuddered at the memory, then peered up at me.
"Gunlias raped Numui, right?"
"Yes." I wondered how he knew.
"Foolish man.
Foolish man!"
He seemed amused rather than angry at his lover's fate.
"How he will suffer. Is Numui angry?"
"Furious."
"Good. Fury is very useful. And dear Numui has a talent for it. One of the things I can't stand about Christians is their admiration of meekness. Imagine elevating meekness into a virtue. Meekness! Can you imagine a heaven filled only with the meek? What a dreadful idea. The food would get cold while everyone passed the dishes to everyone else. Meekness is no good, Derval. Anger and selfishness, those are the qualities that make the world march."
He laughed.
"Now, about Colethin. He was a fair druid for an Ordovician. Not nearly as good as me, of course, but he had his better days. I did enjoy your attempt to murder Lancelot, by the way. A pity you didn't finish the job. I suppose he escaped from the city?"
"As soon as it was doomed, yes."
"Sailors say rats are always first off the doomed ship. Poor Ban. He was a fool, but a good fool."
"Did he know who you were?" I asked.
"Of course he knew," Merlin said. "It would have been monstrously rude of me to have deceived my host. He didn't tell anyone else, of course. Otherwise I'd have been besieged by those dreadful poets, all asking me to use magic to make their wrinkles disappear. You've no idea, Derval, how bothersome a little magic can be. Ban knew who I was, and so did Kethig. He's my servant. Poor Howl's dead, yes?"
"Well, if you already know," I said, "why do you ask?"
"I'm just making conversation," he protested. "Conversation is one of the civilized arts, Derval. We can't all stump through life with a sword and shield growling. A few of us do try to preserve the dignities.
He sniffed. So how do you know Hal's dead? I asked.
Because Bedwin wrote and told me, of course, you idiot.
Bedwin's been writing to you all these years? I asked in astonishment.
Of course. He needed my advice. What do you think I did? Vanish?
You did, I said resentfully.
Nonsense. You simply didn't know where to look for me. Not that Bedwin took my advice about anything. What a mess the man has made. Mordred alive? Pure foolishness. The child should have been strangled with his own birth cord. But I suppose Uther could never have been persuaded of that. Poor Uther. He believed that virtues are handed down through a man's loins. What nonsense! A child is like a calf. If the thing is born crippled, you knock it smartly on the skull and serve the cow again. That's why the gods made it such a pleasure to engender children, because so many of the little brutes have to be replaced. There's not much pleasure in the process for women, of course, but someone has to suffer. And thank the gods it's them and not us.
Did you ever have children? I asked, wondering why I had never thought to inquire before.
Of course I did. What an extraordinary question.
He gazed at me as though he doubted my sanity.
I never liked any of them very much, and happily most of them died, and the rest I've disowned. One, I think, is even a Christian.
He shuddered.
I much prefer other people's children. They're so much more grateful. Now, what were we talking about? Oh, yes, Colethin, terrible man.
He shook his head gloomily. Did he write the scroll? I asked.
Don't be absurd, Devil, he snapped impatiently. Druids are not allowed to write anything down. It's against the rules, you know that. Once you write something down, it becomes fixed. It becomes dogma. People can argue about it. They become authoritative. They refer to the texts. They produce new manuscripts. They argue more, and soon they're putting each other to death. If you never write anything down, then no one knows exactly what you said, so you can always change it. Do I have to explain everything to you?
You can explain what is written on the scroll, I said humbly.
I was doing precisely that. But you keep interrupting me and changing the subject. Extraordinary behaviour. And to think you grew up on the tour. I should have had you whipped more often. That might have given you better manners. I hear Gwylithon is rebuilding my hall.
Yes.
A good honest man, Gwylithon. I shall probably have to rebuild it all myself, but he does try.
The scroll? I reminded him.
I know, I know. Colethin was a druid, I told you that. An Ordovician, too. Dreadful beasts, Ordovicians. Whatever. Cast your mind back to the Black Year, and ask yourself how Suetonius knew all he did about our religion. Now, you do know who Suetonius was, I suppose?
The question was an insult. For all Britons know and revile the name of Suetonius Paulinus, the governor appointed by the Emperor Nero, and who, in the Black Year, that occurred some 400 years before our time, virtually destroyed our ancient religion. Every Briton grew up with the dread tale of how Suetonius's two legions had crushed the Druid sanctuary on Innis Mon. Innis Mon, like Innis Trebes, was an island, the greatest sanctuary of our gods. But the Romans had somehow crossed the straits and put all the druids, bards, and priestesses to the sword. They had cut down the sacred groves and defiled the holy lake, so that all we had left was but a shadow of the old religion. And our druids, like Tanaburs and Eorwith, were just faint echoes of an old glory.
I know who Suetonius was, I told Merlin.
There was another Suetonius, he said with amusement. A Roman writer, and rather a good one. Man possessed his De Verus Illustribus, which is mainly about the lives of the poets. Suetonius was particularly scandalous about Virgil. It's extraordinary what things poets will take to their beds. Mostly each other, of course. It's a pity that work burned, for I never saw another.
Ban's scroll might well have been the very last copy, and it's just ashes now. Virgil will be relieved.
Whatever. The point is that Suetonius Paulinus wanted to know everything there was to know about our religion before he attacked Innis Mon. He wanted to make certain we wouldn't turn him into a toad or a poet. So he found himself a traitor, Calethin the Druid. And Calethin dictated everything he knew to a Roman scribe, who copied it all down in what looks to be execrable Latin. But, execrable or not, it is the only record of our old religion. All its secrets, all its rituals, all its meanings, and all its power. And this, child, is it.
He gestured at the scroll, and managed to knock it off the table. I retrieved the manuscript from under the shipmaster's bunk. "And I thought," I said bitterly, "that you were a Christian trying to discover the wingspan of angels."
"Don't be perverse, Derval. Everyone knows the wingspan must vary according to the angel's height and weight."
He unwound the scroll again and peered at its contents.
"I sought this treasure everywhere, even in Rome. And all the while that silly old fool Ban had it catalogued as the 18th volume of Silius Italicus. It proves he never read the whole thing, even though he did claim it was wonderful. Still, I don't suppose anyone's read the whole thing. How could they?"
He shuddered. "Well, no wonder it took you over 5 years to find it," I said, thinking how many people had missed him during that time.
"Nonsense. I only learned of the scroll's existence a year ago. Before that, I was searching for other things. The horn of Bran Galed, the knife of Laufrodeth, the throwboard of Gwenthalau, the ring of Elluned, the treasures of Britain, Derval."
He paused, glancing at the sealed chest, then looked back to me.
"The treasures are the keys of power, Derval. But without the secrets in this scroll, they're just so many dead objects."
There was a rare reverence in his voice, and no wonder, for the 13 treasures were the most mysterious and sacred talismans of Britain. One night in Benowick, when we had been shivering in the dark and listening for Franks among the trees, Galahad had scorned the very existence of the treasures, by doubting whether they could have survived the long years of Roman rule. But Merlin had always insisted that the old druids, facing defeat, had hidden them so deep that no Roman would ever find them. His life's work was the collection of the 13 talismans. His ambition was the final awesome moment when they would be put to use. That use, it seemed, was described in the lost scroll of Calethin.
"So what does the scroll tell us?" I asked eagerly.
"How would I know? You won't give me time to read it. Why don't you go and be useful? Splice an oar, or whatever it is sailors do when they're not drowning."
He waited till I had reached the door.
"Oh, and one other thing," he added abstractedly.
I turned to see he was again gazing at the opening lines of the heavy scroll.
"Lord,"
I prompted him.
"I just wanted to thank you, Derval,"
he said carelessly.
"So, thank you. I always hoped you'd be useful some day."
I thought of Innis Treves burning, and of Ban dead. "I failed Arthur," I said bitterly.
"Everyone fails Arthur. He expects too much. Now go."
I had supposed that Lancelot and his mother Elaine would sail west to Priscilliand, there to join the mass of refugees hurled from Ban's kingdom by the Franks. But instead they sailed north to Britain, to Dumnonia. And once in Dumnonia, they travelled to Durnavaria, reaching the town a full 2 days before Merlin, Galahad and I landed. So we were not there to see their entry, though we heard all about it, for the town rang with admiring tales of the fugitives. Benoick's royal party had travelled in 3 fast ships, all of which had been provisioned ahead of Innis Treves' fall, and in those holds were crammed the gold and silver that the Franks had hoped to find in Ban's palace. By the time Queen Elaine's party reached Dernovaria, the treasure had been hidden away, and the fugitives were all on foot, some of them shoeless, all ragged and dusty, their hair tangled and crusted with sea salt, and with blood caked on their clothes and on the battered weapons they clutched in nerveless hands. Elaine, Queen of Benwick, and Lancelot, now king of a lost kingdom, limped up the town's principal street to beg like indigents at Guinevere's palace. Behind them was a motley mixture of guards, poets, and courtiers, who, Elaine pitifully exclaimed, were the only survivors of the massacre.
"If only Arthur had kept his word,"
she wailed to Guinevere.
"If only he had done just half of all that he promised!"
"Mother, mother!" Lancelot clutched her.
"All I want to do is die, my dear,"
Elaine declared,
"as you so nearly did in the fight."
Guinevere, of course, rose splendidly to the occasion. Clothes were fetched, baths filled, food cooked, wine poured, wounds bandaged, stories heard, treasure given, and Arthur summoned. The stories were wonderful. They were told all over the town, and by the time we reached Dernovaria, the tales had spread to every corner of Domnonia, and were already flying over the frontiers to be retold in countless British and Irish feasting halls. It was a great tale of heroes. How Lancelot and Bors had held the Merman Gate, and how they had carpeted the sands with Frankish dead, and glutted the gulls with Frankish offal. The Franks, the tales said, had been shrieking for mercy, fearing that bright Tancredwyr would flash in Lancelot's hand again. But then some other defenders, out of Lancelot's sight, gave way. The enemy was inside the city, and if the fight had been grim before, now it became ghastly. Enemy after enemy fell, as street after street was defended. Yet not all the heroes of antiquity could have stemmed that rush of iron-helmed foes who swarmed from the encircling sea like so many demons released from Manor Whidden's nightmares. Back went the outnumbered heroes, leaving the streets choked with enemy dead. Still more enemies came, and back the heroes went, back to the palace itself, where Ban, good King Ban, leaned on his terrace to search the horizon for Arthur's ships.
"They will come," Ban had insisted, "for Arthur has promised."
The king, the story said, would not leave the terrace. For if Arthur came and he were not there, what would men say? He insisted he would stay to greet Arthur, but first he kissed his wife, embraced his heir, then wished them both fair winds for Britain, before turning to gaze for the rescue that never came. It was a mighty tale, and next day, when it seemed that no more ships would come from far Armorica, the tale changed subtly. Now it was the men of Domnonia, the forces led by Kiluk and Derval, who had allowed the enemy into Innis Trebes. "They fought," Lancelot assured Guinevere, "but they could not hold." Arthur, who had been campaigning against Cerdic Saxons, rode hard for Dernovaria to welcome his guests. He arrived just hours before our sad party trudged unremarked up the road that ran from the sea past the great grassy ramparts of Maidan. One of the guards on the city's southern gate recognized me and let us in.
"You're just in time," he said.
"For what?" I asked.
"Arthur's here. They're going to tell the tale of Innis Trebes."
"Are they now?" I glanced across the town towards the palace on its western hill.
"I'd like to hear that," I said.
Then I led my companions into the town. I hurried towards the crossroads in the centre, curious to inspect the chapel Sansom had built for Mordred. But to my surprise, there was neither chapel nor temple on the site, just a waste space where ragweed grew.
"Namui," I said, amused.
"What?" Merlin asked me. He was cowled so that no one would recognize him. "A self-important little man," I said.
and was going to build a church here. Guinevere summoned Nimue to stop him.
So Guinevere is not entirely without sense? Merlin asked.
Did I say she was?
No, dear Derval, you did not.
Shall we go on?
We turned up the hill towards the palace. It was evening, and the palace slaves were putting torches into beckets about the courtyard, where, heedless of the damage they were causing to Guinevere's roses and water channels, a crowd had gathered to see Lancelot and Arthur. No one recognized us as we came through the gate. Merlin was hooded, while Galahad and I wore the cheek pieces of our wolf-tailed helmets closed across our faces. We squeezed with Kiluk and a dozen other men into the arcade at the very back of the crowd. And there, as night fell, we heard the tale of Innis Treib's fall. Lancelot, Guinevere, Elaine, Arthur, Bors, and Bedwin stood on the eastern side of the courtyard, where the pavement was elevated a few feet above the other three sides to make a natural stage, an impression heightened by the bright torches fixed to the wall beneath the terrace that had steps leading down to the courtyard. I looked for Nimue, but could not see her, nor was young Bishop Sansom there. Bishop Bedwin said a prayer, and the Christians in the crowd murmured their response, crossed themselves, then settled to listen once again to the awful tale of Innis Treib's fall. Bors told the story. He stood at the head of the steps, and he told of Benwick's fight, and the listening crowd gasped as they heard of the horror, and cheered when he described some particular passage of Lancelot's heroism. Once, overcome by emotion, Bors simply gestured at Lancelot, who tried to quell the cheers by raising a hand thickly wrapped in bandages, and when the gesture failed, he shook his head, as though the crowd's praise was simply too great to bear. Elaine, draped in black, wept beside her son. Bors did not dwell on Arthur's failure to reinforce the doomed garrison. Instead, he explained that though Lancelot knew Arthur was fighting in Britain, King Ban had clung to his unrealistic hopes. Arthur, wounded all the same, shook his head and seemed close to tears, especially when Bors told the touching tale of King Ban's farewell to his wife and son. I was close to tears, too, not because of the lies I heard, but out of sheer joy at seeing Arthur again. He had not changed. The bony face was still strong, and his eyes still full of care. Bedwin asked what had happened to the men of Dumnonia, and Bors, with apparent reluctance, allowed the tale of our sorry deaths to be drawn from him. The crowd groaned when they learned that it had been us, the men of Dumnonia, who had yielded the city's wall. Bors raised a gloved hand.
"They fought well,"
he said, but the crowd was not consoled.
Merlin seemed to have been ignoring Bors's nonsense. Instead, he had been whispering with a man at the back of the crowd, but now he shuffled forward to touch my elbow.
"I need a piss, dear boy,"
he said in Father Selwyn's voice.
"Old man's bladder. You deal with these fools and I'll be back soon."
Your men fought well,
Bors shouted to the crowd.
And though they were defeated, they died like men. And now, like ghosts, they're back from the other world,
I shouted. And I clashed my shield against a pillar, shaking free a small cloud of powdered lime. I stepped into the flamelight of a torch.
"You lie, Bors!"
I shouted. Kiluk stepped up beside me.
"I say you lie too,"
he growled.
"And I say it,"
Galahad appeared. I drew Halbane. The scrape of the steel on the scabbard's wooden throat made the crowd shrink back to leave a path through the trampled roses that led towards the terrace. The three of us, battle-weary, dusty, helmed and armed, walked forward. We walked in step, slowly. Then neither Bors nor Lancelot dared speak when they saw the wolf tails hanging from our helmets. I stopped at the garden's centre and slammed Halbane point downwards into a rosebed.
"My sword says you lie," I shouted. "Derval, son of a slave,
says that Lancelot ap Ban, King of Benwick, lies.
Killock ap Galliard says so too.
Killock rammed his battered blade beside mine. And Galahad ap Ban, Prince of Benwick also. Galahad added his sword.
No Franks took our wall,
I said, removing my helmet so that Lancelot could see my face. No Frank dared climb our wall, for there were so many dead at its foot.
And I, brother,
Galahad also removed his helmet, was with our father at the last. Not you.
And you, Lancelot,
I cried,
had no bandage when you fled in his Trebes. What happened? Did a splinter from the ship's gunwale prick your thumb?
There was uproar. Some of Bors' guards were at the side of the courtyard, and they drew their swords and shouted insults. But Cavan and the rest of our men pushed through the open gate with raised spears to threaten massacre.
None of you bastards fought at the city,
Cavan shouted.
So fight now.
Lanville, commander of Guinevere's guard, shouted at his archers to line the terrace. Elaine had gone white. Lancelot and Bors were both at her side, and both seemed to be trembling. Bishop Bedwin was shouting, but it was Arthur who restored order. He drew Excalibur and clashed it against his shield. Lancelot and Bors had shrunk to the back of the terrace, but Arthur waved them forward, then looked at us three warriors. The crowd went silent, and the archers took the arrows off their strings.
In battle, Arthur said gently,
commanding the attention of all the courtyard.
Things are confused. Men rarely see all that happens in a battle. There is so much noise, so much chaos, so much horror. Our friends from Innis Trebes.
And here he laid his sword arm around Lancelot's shoulders.
Are mistaken. But theirs was an honest mistake. Doubtless some poor confused man told them the tale of your deaths, and they believed it. But now, happily, they stand corrected, but not shamed. There was glory enough in Innis Trebes for all to share. Am I not right?
Arthur had directed the question at Lancelot, but it was Bors who answered.
I am wrong, he said, and glad to be wrong.
I also,
Lancelot added in a brave, clear voice.
There,
Arthur exclaimed, and smiled down at the three of us.
Now, my friends, pick up your weapons. We will have no enmity here. You are all heroes, all of you.
He waited, but not one of us moved. The torch flames glanced off our helmets and touched the blades of our planted swords that were a challenge for a fight to establish the truth. Arthur's smile disappeared as he drew himself to his full height.
I am ordering you to pick up your swords, he said. This is my house. You, Killock, and you, Derval, are oath sworn to me. Are you breaking your oaths?
I am defending my honour, Lord,
Killock answered.
Your honour is in my service, Arthur snapped,
and the steel in his voice was enough to make me shiver. He was a kind man, but it was easy to forget that he had not become a warlord by mere kindness. He spoke so much of peace and reconciliation, but in battle his soul was released from such concerns and gave itself to slaughter. He threatened slaughter now by putting his hand on Excalibur's hilt.
Pick up the swords, he ordered us, unless you wish me to pick them up for you.